listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again James Rickards. James is the author of the best-selling Currency Wars, and that was published in 2011. He, however, has a new edition coming out sometime later this year, probably in December. He's also authored some other books that I have on my shelf here, The Death of Money. Is another one. And, well, he's been involved in the financial markets a good part of his life. He's also been involved as an analyst for the various government agencies. He's been, he is a lawyer. He has a law degree in taxation. Well, he has a very well-rounded background in economics, finance. He's theoretical as well as a real-world guy. So it's always good to have Jim with us. Thanks for being with me again, Jim.
It's great to be with you, Jay. Thanks for inviting me.
Always good to have you. You know, I want to ask you, I guess before we get into some of the topics, I really want to ask you about your Currency Wars book. That's going to come out in December, I think you told me. And what's going to be different about the Currency Wars, this edition? Will it be just an update of some things that's happened since 2011 in the Currency Wars?
Well, it's a little more than an update. Thanks, Jay. The original Currency Wars came out in 2011. The new edition, it will still be called Currency Wars. It's the same book, basically, with a lot of new writing and a lot of new material. So what I did really is I updated it, but it includes a large introduction, about 5,000 words, which is the length of a full chapter, that's completely new. And then as you go through the book, there's a lot of updates, new material. The one of the things I said in Currency Wars when it came out in 2011 is that the world is not always in a currency war, but when we are, they can last for 5 or 10 or 15 or even 20 years. And we should expect this one to last an amount of time similar to that. So I'm not surprised that here we are in 2017 going into 2018, and we're still in a currency where we're still talking about, you know, President Trump possibly labeling China a currency manipulator and, you know, a lot of volatility in the euro-dollar cross race. So the currency wars are still going on. Again, comes as no surprise, exactly what I said in the book in 2011. But at the same time, the book kind of stops cold in 2011. Of course, that's when it was published. But at the time, as you know, the dollar was at an all-time low. Using the Fed's broad index, the dollar was at an all-time low, and gold was at an all-time high. Since then, gold came down 50% before rallying back somewhat, and the dollar rallied very strongly. So those positions reversed. Now they may be reversing again with the dollar coming down a little bit and gold getting stronger. But the point being, the book needed updating, particularly what I call for the age of Trump. So the title is still going to be Currency Wars, but I'm thinking about it sort of Currency Wars for the age of Trump. You know, what's new? And one of the really new material, new pieces of material I developed is this sequence, this dynamic, beginning with currency wars, leading into trade wars, and then shooting wars. Now, the trade wars and the shooting wars were not really on the horizon when I wrote Currency Wars in 2011, but today we are. And again, it's the same pattern we saw in the 1930s, where you had currency wars beginning in the 1920s, early 1930s, and then a global trade war in the early to mid-1930s, and then from the mid-1930s forward, you had a shooting war. So I see that same dynamic playing out where the currency wars are now turning into trade wars. We saw Trump withdraw from TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, threatened to terminate NAFTA, threatened to terminate the Korean-U.S. trade agreement, imposing sanctions on China. Not all of those things have come to pass, but they've all been talked about. They're all on the radar screen. So we're kind of at the trade war stage, and I think the shooting war, particularly with regard to North Korea, is not far behind. So I work on that thesis as well. So the book, when it comes out, probably in early December, it'll be the same cover, same title, but it'll be a second edition, very fresh, very contemporary.
Jim, maybe you could just take a moment to explain to us what currency wars are, what are some of the battles within the currency wars, and why do we have them?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned battles, Jay, because that's that confuses a lot of people. You know, in a real war, it's not all fighting all the time. You have intense fighting punctuated, and then there are periods of rest and regrouping, and then new battles break out. So in, you know, World War II, you had the D-Day invasion and the Battle of the Bulge, but there were relatively quiet periods in between. Same thing in a currency war. We've been in a currency war since 2011, and you'll see something like the extremely weak euro in late 2015, where the euro was down to, you know, kind of 105 and almost 103, going to par, which it didn't. I didn't think it would, but a lot of people were expecting that, and people were accusing, they were saying, oh, there's a new currency war, and I kept making the point, well, it's not a new currency war, it's the same currency war, this is just a new battle. Now, the thing that causes currency wars, it arises from a situation of too much debt and not enough growth. So too much debt, not enough growth. Exactly the situation we find ourselves in today, and that the world found itself in 1919 after World War One with the Versailles Treaty, when there was unpayable debt and insufficient growth, and that's when a currency war one broke out. But normally when you have enough growth, large countries like the United States don't really care about the exchange rate. If we have sufficient growth and debt's under control and some country wants to devalue against the dollar, nobody cares. But when you don't have enough growth, devaluation is a way to steal growth from your trading partners. You cheapen your currency, that helps your exports, creates export-related jobs, makes imports more expensive, so that helps your balance of trade surplus, which helps your growth. And so it's just a way of stealing growth from your trading partners. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. The reason it doesn't work is because of retaliation. Somebody devalues against you, you turn around and devalue against them, they do it again, you do it again, it's a race to the bottom, nobody's any further ahead. So we're in that situation today where there's too much debt, not enough growth. We've also seen these tit-for-tat devaluations where I've tracked seven moves of 20% or more in the euro-US dollar cross rate in both directions. You know, from the euro went from $1.60, down to $1.20, then back up to $1.40, and then down to $1.05, and now it's back up to around $1.20. I mean, these are currency wars with a vengeance, but it makes the point that, you know, is the euro getting weaker, stronger? Is the dollar getting weaker, stronger? Well, they both things are happening at once. It's just like two kids on a seesaw. One's up and the other's down. And it goes back and forth. But nobody's any further ahead at the end of the day. And then that's when people are tempted into trade wars. They go, well, put some tariffs on. But those don't work either. And then a war breaks out. That actually does work. There's good evidence that actual warfare does destroy enough wealth that it helps wipes out debt, because it wipes out debtors and helps growth on a going forward basis because you've done so much destruction.
So debt is destroyed, and therefore you can start over again. Is that the idea?
Exactly.
And like a debt forgiveness helps too, but I mean, we have to kill a bunch of people first, I guess, to make it happen.
Well, if you wipe out a country, you wipe out the debt, and then again you can start over.
Oh, God help us. Well, I suppose that's where we're at, Jim. I mean, it seems like there's constant wars. Yeah, I mean, one of the ideas that I got from you before was one of the reasons that, countries like China and Russia and others, they are engaging in currency wars as well against the dollar, right? And one of the ideas that I got from you was that they had to fight in that manner because they certainly couldn't win in a conventional war. So what I'm hearing you saying is that we're moving towards some sort of a trade war, which then is, in essence, it's a declaration of war, I guess, when you decide not to trade with other, you blockade or you keep other countries' goods from coming in. And that's kind of an aggressive act in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, I do think it can be regarded as an act of war. In fact, General McMaster, H.R. McMaster, who's the National Security Advisor to President Trump, recently said that we no longer distinguish between kinetic weapons and financial weapons. They're all weapons. They're all elements of war. So whether it's cyber warfare, psychological operations, financial warfare, kinetic warfare, they're all just tools in the toolkit. So they don't even make a distinction. And it's the sequence I described, going from currency wars to trade wars to shooting wars. it is a powerful dynamic. You can trace it, but it's not all neat and tidy. There are some overlaps, and I think we're in a stage now where the currency wars and the trade wars are overlapping. We're seeing both, and I expect we'll be launching an attack on North Korea in the next 6 to 8 months. But that won't make the currency wars go away. It just means that we'll have all three at once. So it's a little bit messy, but that is the dynamic, and it happens because the currency wars and trade wars don't really do any good. I mean, they people think they do. They try them. They're tempting. But at the end of the day, you're no further ahead.
Well, China and Russia, the BRICS, to a certain extent, have made it known that they're not happy about their position at the IMF. And they've set out their own trade and banking infrastructure, the One Belt, One Road initiative that China is involved with. How seriously do you take that, and how seriously do you think the United States takes that, let's say, from a geopolitical point of view?
I take it seriously. I'm not sure the United States government does. I've had had quite a few conversations with officials, current and former officials at the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve and the military and intelligence officials, and it's hard to find anyone who thinks there's any cause for concern that the dollar won't always be, king of the hill. I was in one war game meeting at the Pentagon. I was sitting next to one seat away from a senior U.S. Treasury official, and I said something along the lines I'm saying in this interview, talking about, you know, the IMF and the SDR and the role of the dollar being diminished. And this guy just kind of harumphed and said, you know, what are you talking about with these SDRs? Don't you know that the dollar has been the global reserve currency? It's the global reserve currency today, and it always will be the leading reserve currency. And I just said, you know, I feel like I'm sitting in Whitehall in 1913 listening to, you know, John Bull talk about how the sterling will always be the global reserve currency. And of course, a few years later, it was the beginning of the end. And 30 years later, the sterling was greatly devalued and completely displaced by the dollar. So I do detect some complacency on the part of the U.S. government, unfortunately. But that doesn't change the reality on the ground. The fact is, Russia has tripled its gold reserves in the last 10 years. China has tripled its gold reserves in the last 10 years. You have to ask yourself, are they stupid or do they see something coming that most people don't? Well, I've been to Russia and China. I have a lot of friends in both places. I follow them closely. They're not stupid. They know what they're doing. And what it means is that they see a return to gold as a monetary asset and a diminution of the role of the dollar. The fact that America doesn't see it is unfortunate for us.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you about that, James, because I've seen things in the press about China and Russia preparing to trade. More and more over time, using dollars to a less extent. After Nixon took us off the gold standard in 1971, Kissinger arranged for the creation of the petrodollar with our friends, quote unquote, in Saudi Arabia, setting them up and defending and protecting them. And then we saw countries, maybe it was a coincidence or not, but countries like Iraq or Gaddafi's Libya deciding they wanted to go in a different direction and not accept dollars anymore. Their regimes weren't long for the lasting. I just wonder, though, with Russia and China seem to be, I mean, China's talking about buying its oil, and I'm presuming maybe from countries like Russia and Iran to start with their RMB backed by gold if need be. So in other words, they'll pay the Russians RMB. The Russians want to have gold and not RMB. They can have their gold, I guess. That's my understanding. Is this something that you think is actually happening or will happen soon, Jim? And to what extent might it be a threat to the dollar's hegemony?
It is happening. It's happening now, and I think it's a very serious threat. I think it's the beginning of the end of the petrodollar. Now, the petrodollar, I'm sure a lot of listeners are familiar, was sort of invented or imposed, I think is a better word, by Henry Kissinger and others in 1974. It was Henry Kissinger. William Simon was Secretary of the Treasury at the time. His deputy was a guy named Jerry Parsky. Kissinger's deputy national security advisor was someone named Helmut Sonnenfeld. Helmut was also from Germany. He was known as Kissinger's Kissinger. Kissinger was a big brain, and Helmut Sonnenfeld was the big brain behind Kissinger. I actually met with Sonnenfeld and a couple others in the White House in 1974, at the time of the creation of the petrodollar, and we were working on a plan to actually invade Saudi Arabia and take over the oil fields, establish a security perimeter. We weren't going to steal the oil. We were just going to pump it and price it on our terms, and then we could take the money and kind of hold it in trust for the Saudi people. But it was more a way of controlling the supply and the price rather than actually stealing it. Fortunately, that plan never went forward, but it served a purpose. It was a threat. It was a carrot and stick approach, or a kind of good cop, bad cop routine. So what Kissinger and Parsky did, and Bill Simon, they said to the Saudis, look, we want you to price oil in dollars. We want you to accept dollars for oil. Implicitly, if you don't, there's this other group over here. They're ready to invade, take over your oil fields. Mm-hmm. So like I say, it was a threat, but the Saudis agreed to the petrodollar deal. And the way it worked was that they sold us oil. We paid them dollars. They then took the dollars and put it into the U.S. banks, Citibank and the Chase Bank at the time. I actually worked for Citibank for 10 years, not long after the incident I described. I worked there from the late 70s to the mid-80s, but then Citibank would take the money and lend it to places like Chile and Mexico and Argentina and Brazil, and then they could buy machinery and equipment from the United States, and we would earn the dollars back and then use those to buy the oil. Mm-hmm. So it was just a way of lubricating the system, getting the money merry-go-round up and running again after the severe recession, market collapse, and oil embargo of 1974. And it worked. It worked brilliantly. And besides which, once you price oil in dollars, everybody needs oil. That means everybody needs dollars, because you need the dollars to buy the oil. So that put a floor under the dollar and made it the global reserve currency it is today. It already was, but that really strengthened the dollar and really solidified its position after the end of the Bretton Woods gold standard. So that worked fine for 40 years. Now here we are, and we're seeing that undone. And the particular initiative you mentioned, so China is saying, look, we're the world's largest oil importer. So they're saying to Russia and Saudi Arabia and others, we would like you to sell us oil in yuan, the same way the United States said we'd like you to sell us oil in dollars. But so if you're Russia and you're an oil exporter, you're like, well, okay, but what am I going to do with the yuan? I mean, there's not a big yuan market. There's not a lot of things I can invest in, et cetera. And China says, no problem. You can take the yuan that you get from us and sell it spot for gold on the Shanghai Gold Exchange. Now you got gold. And if you said, well, yeah, but gold's volatile, in euros and yen and dollars, it's up and down. It's like, okay, no problem. You can hedge the gold on the Shanghai Futures Exchange. So you need to take three contracts. You need the oil yuan contract. You need the yuan gold contract on the Shanghai Gold Exchange, and then the gold futures contract on the Shanghai Futures Exchange. But if you put it all together, stitch it together with straight-through processing, in effect, the seller can get hard currency if they want, or gold if they want. But what China accomplishes is you establish a yuan benchmark price for oil, and you get people used to the idea of accepting yuan for oil. That's the beginning of the end of the petrodollar. It doesn't happen overnight. I'm not saying the dollar goes to zero overnight. What I'm saying is that it's a slow, steady drip, drip, drip erosion. And so combine what we just said with the acquisition of gold by Russia and China, and then throw distributed ledger technology and cryptocurrencies into the mix, and you've got a kind of pretty toxic formula for the dollar.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Well, I can't help but wonder how the United States would take it if Saudi Arabia started selling their oil to China for renminbi or gold.
Well, China's their biggest customer. Saudi does not sell most of their oil to the U.S. We actually the U.S. is a competitor. We're an oil exporter now because of fracking and some other developments. So I think Saudi has to sort of be nice to their customers.
Interesting. It's really fascinating stuff, James. I just have to wonder if, let's say the dollars, so you don't think, what is your outlook on the dollar right now, just with a couple of minutes left? What do you think about the dollar, and how soon might we see, we're looking at a weaker dollar now. Is this just a blip, or do you think we might be in for some more weakness in the dollar? And if so, how soon do you think this dollar hegemony will end?
Well, you know, the currency wars are alive and well, and you're right. Over most of 2016, the dollar was getting weaker, but very recently, meaning from the middle of September until early October, the dollar is getting a lot stronger. That's because the market has taken the view that the Fed's going to raise interest rates in December. The Fed's on in a tightening mode, and they started this QT, quantitative tightening, balance sheet normalization. So all this is making the dollar a lot stronger, and the euro's down from 120 to 117. I expect that will reverse pretty violently, and suddenly as we get closer to December and it becomes apparent that the Fed cannot raise interest rates, which is my forecast, based on disinflation, which is kind of the Fed's worst nightmare. So I think the market, I hate to say the market's right or wrong, the market is what it is, and nobody wants to stand in front of a moving train. Right. But my expectation is the market will get a wake-up call. We'll see the Fed's not going to raise rates. That's a form of ease. The dollar will weaken. But this is kind of the normal day-to-day back and forth of the currency wars. But the bigger picture you're talking about, Jay, it's not that the dollar will go away. Yeah. We'll still have dollars, but it'll be like Mexican pesos. It'll be a local currency you use while you're in the United States, but it won't be the global benchmark. That may happen faster than we think. Yeah. Not overnight. It's not like we go to bed and wake up and the dollar's gone. But with these developments in the SDR and gold and the distributed ledger technology, it could happen faster than we think.
All right, Jim, 30 seconds. How can people buy your book when it comes out in December? Where can they buy it?
Thank you. The best place is Amazon. It's available in your local bookstores. It'll have a badge on it. So make sure if you're interested in the new one, if you already have the existing one, make sure you're getting the new edition. But there'll be something to indicate that. But Amazon's a good place to do it.
Oh, excellent. Well, thank you for being with us again, James. Always a pleasure. Hope to have you back again sometime in the near future. Well, folks, that is all the time we have for this week. Next week, my guest will be Brent Cook and John Kaiser to talk about the hottest stock on the planet. That's a company that is also a sponsor of this show. I'm talking about Dr. Quinton's Novo Resources, which has risen about tenfold over the past few months. It should be an exciting show. I hope you'll join me then. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.